Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Ben Marcus, author of Notes from the Fog, his collection of short stories, published this month by Knopf. When last we heard from Ben here on the show, we were talking about his novel, The Flame Alphabet, a book that in some ways, in my opinion, shares many of the characteristics as some of the stories do. As you may recall also, Ben is the author of several books. As I mentioned, The Flame Alphabet, The Age of Wire and String, Leaving the Sea, and Notable American Women. His writing has appeared in Harper's, The New Yorker, The New York Times, many other prestigious publications. He's the editor of New American Stories. He's won 3 Pushcart Prizes. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and has been a member of the faculty of Columbia since 2000. Okay, that's enough, I guess. Notes from the Fog is a collection of stories about lots of people, all interesting and most of them sad or lost. A little boy who isn't what he's supposed to be, and parents who are sad and angry that he turns into a child that they never expected. A man whose life is completely and utterly ruined by the corporate experiment that's grown horribly wrong. And there's a lot of money involved in that. In fact, a lot of money involved in many of the stories. A husband and wife architectural team whose marriage is not what it should be and whose designs reflect that to a certain extent. And also from where the title of this collection kind of arises. A mother who then becomes the mother of her sister's orphaned boys, and in the meantime establishes an unusual relationship with those boys' parents, revolving around a series of $200 payments. A pill that makes you happy or not, but that just won't stay down. And many others with equally troubling, sometimes distressing premises that lead to a feeling that you have just read something that might change your life, or then again might not. So with that seesaw of an introduction, welcome, Ben, and thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So last time we talked, one of the last things I asked you was, why did you say he had to flame a choker of cured meat instead of just, say, broiling a steak? And I think you said to me you didn't even know why you did that, which reminded me of an interview you did recently where you said, I always tell myself this next one won't be fantastical and will be very plain and believable, but I don't know why I tell myself that because I don't ever seem to listen. And I think in this book you didn't listen either. Why is that?
Yeah, I don't follow my own advice. I think maybe like a lot of writers, I do a certain kind of work and then look at it and have misgivings and wish it might be better, different. And I'm always kind of haunted by what it might be. And I think sometimes I have felt that I've used fantastical or otherworldly or strange doings in a story as a kind of crutch to keep me from something a little maybe more emotional, something more relatable. But there are a few stories in here that actually don't have anything fantastical. They might be unusual, but these are things that could happen in our world. I think Cold Little Bird is among those, where it's really just a story about a strange kid and how the parents react.
But Critique is not.
It certainly isn't. That would be the other end as far out as it gets. And Critique is it's a story that kind of looks at the entire world as something that was made by someone, as if it was made by an artist, and it kind of critiques things like trees and space. And that's decidedly different. And, you know, I like writing in both ways, and I'm not interested in restricting myself. But, I wanted to, as I was writing these stories, I would look at what I had done and think, okay, I need to try something different now. You know, I've had so many stories about this or that. So, you know, Critique came about because I was looking at what I had done and thought, well, I want to do something that's really has no characters in it and is just almost like a pure essay posing as fiction.
You know, I read Jonathan Franzen's article about experimental fiction, and then I read your what I call a retort. And, you know, to me, Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections was kind of good, and then everything after that kind of became like a combination of Oprah and the Reader's Digest. But what I don't understand, I guess, is you're talking about experimental fiction, both of you, and I guess I don't know what the experiment actually is.
Yeah, it's a great question, because the word itself, it just sort of crumbles the more you poke at it. Either everything we do is an experiment, because there isn't a formula or a pattern to write a short story or a novel, right? You don't receive a set of instructions that you enact. You experiment. You look at what's been done and think about what you've read and think about the story you want to tell, but you have to find your own way to do it. Now, some of those ways are very much within a tradition and seem kind of not to veer very far away from the ways other people have done it. And other people want to make their own mark and put their own stamp on it. You know, in something like painting, we don't really worry about this question, because painters, let's say, who go to art school, they're supposed to kind of come up with a new way to paint, right? They're not, no one's like, look, you know, Chagall was a great painter, why don't you just make a Chagall painting? You kind of can't do that. So the art world functions a little differently from the literary world in that way, right? The art world is putting more conscious, overt pressure on younger artists to do something, at least seemingly different. And I think we know it's very, very hard to do, and you can very often find traces of influence in everything. So I don't use the word experimental a lot in relation to fiction, because honestly, I've just stopped really knowing what it's meant to mean. And, you know, there's also some big mainstream books that are very ambitious and innovative and even avant-garde. I don't know, I'm thinking of Saunders, Lincoln and the Bardo, or Tom McCarthy's Remainder, or Sheila Hedy's How Should a Person Be? These are well-published mainstream books, and yet they're radical. They're different. There's really nothing like them. So yeah. Who knows what that word means anymore?
But you take a book like All the Light We Cannot See. Granted, it has a very perfect narrative, but I still feel like it's separate from other books that I've read recently, because, or even Rules of Civility or Gentleman in Moscow. It's just because they're written as, you know, I own a bookstore and I have these books on the front table, and I know which ones are written as literature and which ones aren't. And I know All the Light We Cannot See is literature, but I know Gone Girl isn't. And I just know that. But I don't look at it as being experimental, but I do look at it as being extremely talented. And then when I look at your books or some of the other books like yours that really go out on a limb, I say, yeah, this is different. You know, I say to people, if you want to read something that's completely different and, you know, it's just something that you're not going to find anywhere else, here's a book. And then I pick up your book and hand it to them. And I don't do like a hard sell, but I just tell them that. And I know there's certain people that will like that, and certain people that are like the girl that swung from a whatever.
Right. You know, there's and honestly, I just feel that there's room for everything, and people should read what they want. And if you're curious about things, you should read them. It's hard to feel too worked up about any of this. And I've been writing for a long time now, and I'm not deliberately trying to be different, or like I don't have some kind of statement to make in that way. It's just I'm trying to write the way I think will be most interesting and most powerful and most moving, right? There's nothing else to it. It's not like some chess calculation where I'm looking out there and saying, okay, how do I differentiate myself? It's just, you know, I think language is a very private, strange, kind of unknowable beast, and we all have a different relationship to it, right? And the way it sounds to us, the way we sound it back into the world. So, you know, I do love the many traditions of literature. And, you know, a lot of my favorite short story writers would be considered basically traditional. But I love what can be done with the form. And I'm really interested in trying to do that. But I also think it comes out differently when we try to engage the tradition. So you know, this big argument, I guess, between me and friends and long ago now, it seems less, I guess, just less potent. I'm not sure really what the argument is anymore. At the time, I felt that he was trying to assert that, let's say, more unusual experimental writing was actually bad for literature because it would scare away readers, and readers would feel intimidated by the kind of thing they couldn't understand. And I just
didn't really buy that.
No. That felt sort of censorious, and it felt kind of problematic. Now, though, I think, I don't know, like one of the biggest books of the summer is Tessa Moshfegh's book, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, and it's just an astoundingly good book, but it's deeply strange and unusual, and it really is kind of like unlike anything I've read. And so it doesn't look like some cynical mainstream book designed to sell a million copies. It's a book by a real artist, and yet she's a storyteller, and she can reach readers. And so I feel excited about some of the big mainstream books that are coming out that are not like other things we've seen before.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, like Rivka Galchin and the Flamethrowers. Yeah, what's her name?
That's right.
Yeah.
Rachel Kushner, and then this new Laura Vandenberg novel, The Third Hotel, which is so good. So, I don't know. You know, I feel I get asked a lot about what experimental writing is and what it should be and all of that, and I need to retire as an ambassador.
Well, that's like, even if you go back to, like, Ray Bradbury, those short stories were kind of experimental because, you know, they scared the heck out of...
Absolutely.
And
they were really unlike anything.
Yeah.
That's why the word starts to just lose its meaning to me.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, and the other thing is, and this goes back to the book, and this you might get, this might be part of the irritating part of the interview, but there was a Ray Bradbury story once where this guy, he looked in the mirror and he was really scared because he knew his skeleton was inside his body, and he hated the idea of that skeleton. It scared the hell out of him. So he hired this guy to put a card under his door that came and took his skeleton out of his body, and he became like this gelatinous blob on the floor. And the last line is a guy walking down the street using the guy's humerus as he had put holes in it and using it as a flute. And it was like, so what that reminds me of is you do this thing like John Irvin kind of does sometimes, and you either know it or you don't. But for example, you can stop me whenever you want. You talk about soft, and this is like the flame alphabet in the meat. You talk about soft bones and sauce, or puddle contained barely by a few odd bones, boiling the children down for parts, a face carved from lamb meat. Their bones came out, fleshy machines, full-scale human melt, bodies reduced to liquid pouring from a window. A layer of fur would cover them with moist parts and teeth, soft people swallowing each other, break my face into dust, climbing into someone's head until evidence leaks forth, lips boiled down to a sticky wound, boiled face man, and a lump of meat moving under a rug, and the last one reduced to meat and bone, a few stray teeth, and a pile of hair. And
it's really damning to hear it all like that.
But they're in there, and it's like, I really like them, but it's like it's like you're boiling people and making them soft and fleshy, or messing up their faces or something, you know?
I guess when I'm probably a bad person at interpreting stuff I've written, but when I think about it, I guess to me it's those lines maybe are about pointing out our vulnerability and our fragility, just how we aren't that much as physical objects, that there's not necessarily a lot to us, and it wouldn't take much for us to kind of melt away. And yet we have an enormous sense of our own importance. We have to believe that what we are is significant and has weight and matters, you know, otherwise there's sort of no point to live. And I think that I'm attracted to descriptions like that because they maybe tear away at the idea of our importance a little bit, or just they show our vulnerability, our fragility, our impermeability. So, you know, our transience. And probably in a lot of those stories that those quotes from, there is some effort to show, a kind of soft underside to things. I keep returning to the word vulnerability. I guess it's the one that's on my mind right now. But it's not just meant to be gruesome or gory or even at all. That's sort of not that interesting to me. But it is interesting to think of how tenuous our form is as people.
Yeah, there's this other science fiction story about this alien race that comes to our planet, and they're like walking up in buildings and houses and stuff, and they're going, they're scared to death. They go, "Why do you do this stuff out of matter? Matter is like this building could break up and we could fall and kill ourselves. Why don't you just do it out of pure energy? Why don't you just use energy to build instead of this matter crap?" I mean, it's like horrible. Yeah. It's like scares the hell out of me, and it reminds me of a technological
problem.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you got these corporations like Mayflower and Thompson and all, and you seem to be concerned a lot about money, especially corporate money. Where did that come from?
It's funny, until you said that, I just had not thought about that at all. I guess it shows up in the Grow Light Blues. They're inventing a new way to feed people that won't take effort and won't waste Earth's resources, and so they activate computer monitors. They mess with the UV spectrum, so nutrition is being passed along by light. And I suppose maybe I'm connecting money to malevolence a little bit, so that as these companies get onto these ideas, they're driven by money, as companies naturally are, but that there are sort of human consequences to that pursuit, right?
Why did Carl even capitulate to volunteering, in quotes, if you will, for the experiment? I guess he was weird already, kind of.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Maybe I think I wanted to set him up as having not a lot to lose. It was clear no one else was volunteering, and then suddenly he was getting a little bit of attention, and suddenly he was a little bit important, and he didn't want to let anyone down, wanted to kind of make a contribution. It's probably true in the real world. Somebody, no one in their right mind would say, "Sure, I'll let you just roast my face with this light."
It's right.
Until I become disfigured.
It reminds me of that poor guy in that movie Office Space. They kept moving him to a smaller and smaller office. But the other thing is, you did this, which is kind of different for you. When I was saying his name is Carl, the names you name people for some reason are really normal this time, like Rachel and Martin and Carl.
Are they not? Are they not always?
Yeah, I guess they are. Well, you got Aniel and Royce, but the rest are Sarah, Harriet, George, Trish. It's like you just decided.
Yeah.
It's like a juxtaposition to, except for that one guy, Maury, or whatever they say Maury, is that his name? Who works for both?
Yeah.
He works for both, and I couldn't figure out whether you kind of meant that, like he switched jobs or something. But anyway,
is Maury in two different stories?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. It's funny. At one point, I think Blueprints of St. Louis and Precious Precious both had a main character with the same name. And I had to go back and change it at the end of finishing both of them. And it felt so strange and wrong. Like, you'd think you could just change a character's name and it shouldn't really mean anything for the story, but I found that it did.
Yeah.
And I have no real understanding of that. And names are just odd and funny and obviously subjective. I just am not that interested in unique names for their own sake. I just didn't want to draw a lot of attention to the names. And there's a nice, to me, contrast to sort of strange dark stories that just feature very normal people.
Yeah, that's the way I look at it.
Or at least names. But maybe it downplays the strangeness a little bit and provides a little ballast.
Well, if you were talking like you were before about some of the more representative stories like Cold Little Bird, what would you do, which you must have contemplated at some time, what would you do if you had a son like Jonah?
Well, I would just lose my mind. I would be so distraught, right? I think that's why that story attracted me, because I can't answer that question. And I think I like dramatic situations like that. I think it would be frustrating maybe to read a story where the sort of response was obvious, right? And I got a lot of mail about that story one way or the other, like people saying, you know, why did he even take any from his son at all? They should have just grounded him. Or, you know, he's clearly abusing his son emotionally. And people reacted in very different ways to that. But I think because I wasn't sure what I would do, that story really attracted me. And that's why I wrote it the way I did. I have been lucky in that both my kids are really emotionally demonstrative, but that maybe made it easy for me to imagine what if one day one of them turned it off and simply, and I think for, yeah, actually I remember now, for a long time I just had a kind of opening line to that story. I didn't know what to do with it, and it was just this kid being tucked in at night, coldly telling his parents he didn't love them anymore, and them sort of thinking, oh, he's tired, or he's goofing around, or he's just trying out some way to talk. But then thinking, well, what happens if he just holds his ground?
Well,
he's
of course.
Like, you know, what if he really means what he says? And so maybe it's a kind of what-if story. But the challenge was then to try to keep it realistic so that he wasn't too monstrous and the parents weren't too monstrous, but the predicament felt somehow real. And I think that's why I also tried to find drama between the husband and wife who are trying to deal with this problem, because parents do, you know, you deal with crises differently when you're raising children with a partner. People will respond differently, and there can be tension in that, or sometimes it's good. So the question of what I would do is, it's a hard one. You know, I think I would try to be as forbearing as I could, as patient as I could, and try to keep my kids safe, but I don't know that there's an easy answer.
Yeah, and I think as opposed to the people who wrote in, it's like it's up to the reader, and I think we talked about this last time. I've talked about it with a lot of authors. You know, it's up to the reader to decide, because I don't know what I would do. I would be very upset, and I don't know whether, you know, my partner would have the same opinion about it as I did. And the funny thing is that, you know, they kind of came together to a certain extent with regard to it. But, you know, one person couldn't handle it at all, and the other person kind of compartmentalized it. But,
yeah
it's kind of, yeah, you know, let's, I got to go back to your language. Because, you know, I don't know why I just thought of this. When Carl emails that picture out, which we won't tell what it is, you say he captured the crag and the woof of it, which is almost Joycean, you know? And I'm thinking, you know, where did he, what the heck is he thinking? You know? The crag and the woof.
I was just trying to be descriptive. I think this is going to be funny for your listeners since they don't know
what it is.
Crag and the woof of what, but...
Well, that's the whole point. They wouldn't know what it is.
That was just in the moment, and it just seemed like something kind of pretty vivid, right? Something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not necessarily a pretty thing being described. I mean, it's not ugly either. It's just,
it is what it is. I thought of the warp and the woof.
It's a fact of nature, but, you know, I'm probably just looking to tilt the decks there a little and to kind of somehow nail the image, right? You know, it's like you're making a little image, and I don't want to do that thing where I write four sentences about it, and it was like this, and it was like that. And, you know, I really resist a lot of similes and a lot of metaphors and just too much description, so it's really about a short, crisp line that you can kind of get out there and pivot off of. And I mean, that's my best attempt to explain it after the fact, but it's a little bit like a baseball swing. You know, you're just like, well, yeah, I swung the bat that way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And the ball,
yeah, I don't know. I think for me, there's not a lot of conscious calculation in sentences like that.
Yeah. The ball leaves the pitcher's glove, and you really don't have any time. You don't have time for thought. Which reminds me, like in the Blueprints for St. Louis, the thing about the couple is, again, Roy and Helen, so they sound like your neighbors, they function so well as partners, almost in a Cary Grant kind of Katharine Hepburn, His Girl Friday kind of way, yet they're so lost in their relationship. And the other thing was, which I thought was wrong of me, I kind of liked Roy better, but I don't know why.
Oh, interesting. That's not wrong. I mean, it's shameful, but not wrong. I'm just kidding. That's interesting.
Because yeah, he seemed to be, you know, he was what he was, and she was constantly...
Yeah.
And that's where the title did come
from.
He's
more carefree. He's more carefree, right?
Yeah.
She's got a lot of agony and tension, but he's also doing what he wants, and he's taking advantage of their marriage.
And she's trying to create things, again, like you do all the time, that might exist in the real world, but then again... Like you say, Notes from the Fog and in that bell jar, it's like they might exist in the real world, but who's the person that's going to create them?
Yeah, I mean, that one is a little bit of a step into the future. I think at first I was thinking, well, you know, what if there were so many, you know, terrorist attacks, God forbid, that there's a little cottage industry in creating memorials and monuments, and right?
Yeah.
And when you go to Europe, too, I've struck by this in Berlin, where there are so many monuments to the Holocaust, right? In some kind of long stretch of retribution and sort of taking ownership of history, the city is going out of its way now to create all these monuments, memorials, and museums. And so as I started to think about that, it led me into just the architectural challenges and also this one conceit that, you know, if you build a monument to a catastrophe, you want people to feel a certain thing when they're in it, right? When I go down to the reflecting pools at the 9/11 site, I mean, they're really moving and clearly took a lot of thought, but also have to fight through an incredible just bureaucratic nest of committees and approvals, and right, the stakeholders for projects like that are just so numerous. So all of that was interesting to me, and you know, then I guess got interested in this idea that pharmaceutical companies were like, well, look, we can assist your project by just like drugging the people who come in and look at it.
It's like when I go to I'm sick of going to both places, but when I go to Disney World and Epcot, when you walk down Main Street, I'm sure they put something in. It smells. The smell makes you feel.
Well, right. I mean, it's a version of that, right? In the
yeah.
same way, like McDonald's is reported to, you know, pump its, you know, alluring to some scent out into the street. And honestly, like, why wouldn't you? I mean. Why wouldn't an architect want to kind of assist the emotional experience of the viewer? And, you know, as writers, we're very consciously trying to create an experience that will cause a lot of feeling in our readers. And you, when you hear architects discuss what they hope their work will achieve, there's a version of that as well, right? How the space is supposed to make people feel when they inhabit it or when they, you know, navigate it. So... I guess I was looking for something that felt almost like organic and inevitable and not just some weird idea, but something
right.
that kind of had a degree of believability to it, even though obviously it's not really happening.
Well, you know, for the reader, it's like, why shouldn't fragrance aroma be a part of architecture? I mean, there's really no reason why it shouldn't.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I mean, I talked myself into it pretty fast. Maybe I needed to because I got interested in that. But then also, I didn't want it to be the main event of that story. Like, the idea was to try to bury it a little bit under different dramas. So that was just this thing that the husband and wife had to work around because you get extra sponsorship for it. You get some money. And it just became a fact of their creative lives that they had to navigate it in the same way they would be navigating the wishes of a client. You know, and in the case of a memorial, I think that, you know, the very real kind of political power of the survivor or the family of the victims, right?
Yeah.
They play a real role in those discussions. And I think for the architects, it's just many different kind of stakeholders that they have to navigate.
In another way, like in The Boys, the aunt, who I don't think has a name, I'm not sure, but but he does. But she has her own peculiarities, and but she accepts them very easily, and some of them are a little strange. But she seems to be, to me, the most centered and good person in the entire collection. It seems like she means only the best, takes those issues for granted, and lets go of, which I can't do, let's go of the characteristics and foibles or whatever that others might find distasteful in their lives. And the husband, her husband, and her teenage girls were nice. And and her final goal was nice, too. And at first you thought, oh, no, it's this rough exterior, and then it turns out she has a heart of gold. I thought it was really nice.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I think it surprised me how that story turned out. And I think when I look at it now, I think she comes on kind of very cynical. And it seems like what I notice after the fact is what I do often is I set something up one way and try to reverse it by the end of the story, or take it through a series of reversals. So, you know, she's completely indifferent to these two kids and to boys in general.
Right.
At the start of the story. And at the end, she's kind of a protective caretaker. So, like, to me, I guess that's what plot is. It's not the stuff that happens, but the emotional change in the character, if you can kind of find a way to do that. That's what interests me, but I also find it very difficult to do in a way that's believable, convincing, and interesting. And, you know, and there's a lot of other stuff going on in that story, like what happens with her and her sister's, her dead sister's husband, that, you know, was interesting to me for other reasons, and I had to try to figure out a way to make those things work together. But I do like trying to find a way to get to a more unexpected emotional place. And there at the end, there is this feeling like these boys have just been rescued. Whereas at first, they're kind of almost sort of just nameless kind of creatures who were not, it's not clear we're meant to care about them at all.
Yeah, they're like woodland creatures.
It's just she's annoyed by them. She doesn't want to deal with them, really. She's out there just out of obligation, and then something happens while she's there.
Yeah, you started out, and inevitably something happens, someone dies. Another weird thing that I'll bring up, because I like to segment the interview this way, is that I don't think anybody ever, in any book ever, has created two cocktails and two different stories that are seemingly made, at least in part, from pork. And the grease that felt strange like a piece of pork. You know,
I can think of one of them from George and Elizabeth. What's the other?
Pattern has...
That one.
It's called pork glass or something.
Pork glass, yeah.
What the hell? I mean, what the hell are you thinking?
What's the other one?
The other one, it's not really pork, I guess. It's in they're having the after work get together, and he's drinking that sludge like.
There's like mud. It's mud, right?
But I don't. You don't really go into what it is completely, but it sounded like something like pork.
Meat. Precious.
Yeah, right. Which is a good title.
Right now.
You have a lot of massages in the book too. Did you know that?
He ordered a drink called Mud.
And
then they're all trying to guess what it is, and he's disgusted by it. I don't know. Someone wanted me to cut that whole part out. I couldn't do it.
No, you can't do it, because that's what makes you you. I mean, a pork cocktail, you know, and the slice of pork is so thin that they have to call it pork glass.
Honestly, it's not that far-fetched if you've ever gone into some wonky bar.
That's true.
But doing radical cocktails, right?
Yeah, but then you got like Pattern, who's
all the elixirs are lined up on the bar, and you can, you know.
Yeah, they have to have elderberry now.
Other weird things.
Yeah, Pattern is like totally off the wall. But you know, there is a there is a suicide tree. You know, it's called the Severa odalum, but it's really a murder tree.
Oh, interesting.
If you eat the nut, it kills you, just like an lethal injection in executions, except it has horrific symptoms leading to your death.
That's interesting. See, I didn't want to refer to it as a suicide tree, but as a suicide of trees, as in like a murder of crows, or,
right,
you know, a gathering of owls or whatever it is. So like,
a suicide,
you know,
trees.
How nouns all have their strange organizing word, and so I was thinking of it that way. That story used to be called other things. It went through a bunch of different titles. That's actually the one story that's older that I wrote a while ago.
Right.
And I didn't put it in my last collection, and then I was looking at it again this time, and then I kind of completely rewrote it, decided to work it in here.
Another phrase that will never appear in literature is, other than yours, is a canoed bodied mother.
Yeah, you think I've got a copyright on that?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how. I think John Updike refers to some woman as porpoise shaped.
Well, that's good, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the other thing you do too is
got to be known for something.
You divide it into four parts, but you seem really disgusted with the seasons, because you go, late in the wretched seasons, April, one of the 12 punishments, a bastard name for a month so numb, winter failed, summer burns out easily. It's like all of a sudden, why is he doesn't like the seasons anymore even?
Isn't that obvious? Because there are no seasons. I don't know where you are right now, but I'm in Maine. It's supposed to be cold.
That's true.
Crazy heat wave. Yeah, that's interesting. You know what? I think part of that is that, you know, I grew up reading what everyone else was reading. And, I remember when I was a lot younger, just being suspicious of descriptions of the natural world, right? Flowers and landscapes and scenery and the seasons and the sun and the moon. These things, to me, as a young, ignorant, opinionated writer, were all kind of these sort of sickly sweet traps for a writer to kind of get into a self-indulgent place of just, I don't know, describing things without a lot of dramatic import. And I want to be clear that I was probably misreading all of that at the time, but it led to a sort of resistance to that. And as things like that have crept back into some of what I write, I think I probably am a little watchful about them and maybe looking to make sure I'm not sentimentalizing these things, right? So if that stuff comes up, maybe I'm trying hard to darken them a little and make them seem a little, just defiantly not sentimental.
Well, you know,
but I don't personally have anything against the seasons, as long as they kind of keep returning.
Well, it goes back to, you know, April's the cruelest month, and I mean, I to me, those things, they don't kind of raise the hackles, but it's like, okay, you immediately think about it, and then you think about why is it, and then you think about why doesn't anybody else ever say something like that, and that's why, and I guess, because we've been doing this for 45 minutes, that's why, I guess, in closing, I want you to keep being fantastical, but I don't think there's anything you can do about it anyway, so.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think, for me, it's been good to try to avoid things or try to pursue other things, even if there's an inevitable result. It's just part of my process, I think. And
someone's always going to grab a big tube of meat and wrap it around something, and it's just the way it's going to be.
They are, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I don't know, the April, I think that line is, along came April, one of the 12 punishments. And, you know, I think it's, if you sort of dig into that, then it's like, well, it's calling every month a punishment, and what kind of character thinks that way, where the month is a punishment? And so maybe it's an attempt at characterization. It's an attempt at showing how this person sees the world and feels the world, rather than saying something definitive about April itself, right?
No, I understand that, and I understand, when someone says winter failed, I mean, yeah, it's, and there are people who And sometimes I, you know, live like that. Maybe not the entire winter, but there are days when you realize, you know, this is not the season that I thought it would be. And those are metaphors. Actually, those are metaphors, right?
Yeah, I think they are. I think they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to make them sort of granular and specific. And
they are.
Not too heavy.
Well,
but I think there is always that danger of creating stories that are too morose, too sad, too kind of overbearingly heavy. And I'm interested in trying to counterbalance that stuff. Because, you know, if you think about that in terms of music, if you listen to some dark, moody piece of music, it gets monotonous very quickly. So I think about that, trying to kind of move away from the obvious pitch of something in order to build up the contrast and heighten the power of returning to that initial grim view of things.
And that's what's so cool about short stories too, which is why I love them so much. Because
absolutely,
yeah,
I completely agree. I you know, and a really good story writer shows you that there's nothing inferior about the story up against the novel. And I'm thinking of Joy Williams, if you read A Visiting Privilege, or it's like new and selected, or maybe collected stories. It's really, nearly every story in that book, and there must be 40, 50 stories. It's just a kind of masterclass on creating an intricate, believable world filled with dramatic conflict and inventive language. And just, you know, I kind of have to catch my breath when I finish a story of hers, and I feel like I've read a whole book. I feel like I've been involved in something enormously complex, and that's really trying to reckon with what life is, right? That's not shying away from the hardest questions and the hardest problems, but it's doing it elegantly with a lot of beauty, a lot of ferocity. So yeah, I love the story when it really lifts into that place.
And it's even like when you go back to Gogol and Tolstoy and Kafka. I mean, when my brother and I every year reread to each other the Nose. I mean, we just laugh. You know, it's like watching the Marx Brothers. It's just, you can't help but be totally. It's so funny, and then the Overcoat makes you want to cry, and then, you know, and then you have Kafka writing Metamorphosis in one night, and you wonder how in the hell, and then you think, why is it that I'll never forget the idea of Gregor Samsa woke one night from troubled dreams to find himself transformed in his bed into a giant cockroach, even though they say insect now, but I like cockroach better.
Yeah, and I always think of that Kafka story, A Country Doctor,
which
is just so terrifying, and very little is even just sort of explained, and that space that he creates to me has always been something I've aspired to.
Well, you had and you have actually, if you talk about experimental fiction, if you look at The Trial or America or The Castle, it's just like your stuff, kind of.
Or Borges too, right?
Those The Library.
I mean, they still look as radical as anything out there.
Or if you go to 100 Years of Solitude, and you think you're going to look at something like The Family Tree and figure it out, and then you find 25 Aurelios, you know? It's like, you know, it's just impossible, yet you somehow understand it. Just like in Love at the Time of Cholera, you don't get it, and then at the end, when there's a boat going down the river, you kind of understand the whole thing, but there's really no reason why you should understand it.
You're right. But, you know, I think it, like, those are the mysteries I really love. And I think in a way, I think it's nice not to understand everything. You know, and sometimes you meet people who want a story explained to them, and you kind of can't do it. And when I think about some of the writing I love the most, it's because it's put me into a state of near comprehension, right? I'm close to
exactly.
Grasping.
Yeah.
But that feels very active and very. You feel really alive, and there's something honest about it, because I think in truth we can't really understand the world and what we're here for and what's happening and what will happen. You know, we come up with little pieces of it and we're really desperately driven to do it, but aren't we very often kind of in a state of, you know, sort of sustained confusion?
Well, maybe that's
protect ourselves from.
Maybe that's it. Maybe, you know, half the readers want their stories or books to be put in a box at the end, wrapped up, tied with a ribbon.
That, yeah.
And maybe that is the difference between Franson and you. I don't know. But it's something like that.
But, and I also really don't, I don't begrudge a reader like that, because I just think there, you know, if you go in a bookstore, you have that option. There are a lot of books that are really going to be very straightforward. And, you know, and I look to other entertainment for something similar. I mean, I think, you know, I might watch bad TV, and I'm not looking for a deep, complex artistic experience. I want something escapist that's going to be kind of funny or ridiculous or, right? And I don't know. I think that in writing, there's really room for all of it, and it seems kind of pointless to start to attack some version of writing. If it's giving people pleasure, then it's really hard to find fault with it.
Yeah. Well, in closing, like I said, you know, my bookstore, which is doing really well, actually.
Good.
Yeah, I'm really happy with it. We're, you know, up year after year, and people come in every day and are really happy with it, and it makes me feel happy. But, you know, the book will be in the front, and what I will do is I'll pick it up when people come in. Not like, you know, I don't go after them, but if I ask them what they're looking for, or if they seem like they're looking for something, I'll pick up this book, and here's what I usually do. Pick up the book, say, here, buy this, read it. If you don't like it, bring it back. And no one ever brings them back. So, I mean...
Well, that's awesome.
Well, you have to gauge your reader, too, but I mean... Yeah, I've done that with your books before, and I've done it with, you know, lots of other ones too, especially like Rules of Civility, for example. But yeah, so I'll keep you
Thank you.
Up there.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
You know?
I think that's I feel lucky as a writer if someone's doing that.
Well,
it's just nice to be on the other end of that.
Yeah, and I feel lucky as a reader to have you out there. So thanks again for being here and listening to me twice, and hopefully maybe another time too.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. It was great to talk with you.
We were talking with Ben Marcus about his new short story collection, Notes from the Fog. Just like all of his other books, it's like you read them and they're just, and you know, you heard me talking. I mean, you read them and they're just so far out there. And some are, as he said, representative kind of literature, but not like Jonathan Franzen, who I have this bias against. But they're like totally out there. And if you're the right kind of reader, yes, I will suggest it to you and you will like it, I promise. So anyway, I really enjoyed, as always, talking to Ben. And hopefully he'll keep coming back, even though I bug him some of the time. But that's one of the reasons why it's a pleasure doing this, because when I get somebody like that, it's like, it really is like Christmas morning. So we got a lot of people coming up, but I don't know in what order, so I won't name them. For the remainder of the summer and then moving into autumn, we have a lot of good authors who will be here talking to us about their newest work, some of which haven't even yet been released. And I look forward to talking with them and having you here next week and the weeks after on The Avid Reader.